I think all of us, even if you don't identify as a quote unquote creative, we are all creative beings. And we all have something that's unique to us or that comes naturally to us that doesn't come naturally to someone else. I think when we embody our gift and we really own our gift and we put it out there for the world to see, whatever it might be, that creative spark that is just innate in you, I think it does create this ability for other people to connect with you because there's just something unspoken there that's picked up on that's like, you're being authentically you, and it gives me permission to be authentically me. And that's a beautiful thing.
Welcome to the Blessings Podcast, where we explore the twists and turns of life in all its perfect imperfection, so you can see how all kinds of other people are just like you. I am Mitzi Campbell, your life story mentor, a transformational teacher, lifelong educator, college professor with decades of work in education, self-development and psychology, nonprofit leadership, and the arts. I am a flower photographer, a yogi, a knitter, a voracious reader, and a mom of three fantastic grown-ups. And I'm so happy to be your host for this experience of connection, gratitude, blessings, and lessons. We are here to see firsthand that people of all walks of life go through things that are invisible on the outside, and that we just never know what our fellow humans are carrying with them on this crazy journey. So get comfy and let's listen with love, compassion, and an open mind as we ditch the small talk and go deep into discovering others so we can better get to know ourselves. Welcome back, friends. Today, you're going to meet a woman that I was immediately drawn to after hearing her speak in Nashville. She's a holistic business coach with a unique and very chic style who has a phenomenal podcast called This or More, where she spills the tea every Tuesday on what it truly takes to thrive as an entrepreneur. I also love that she is a yoga instructor and a redhead. As both a yogi and a mother of redheads, I'm partial to these traits. She knows a thing or two about farm life, and she says that a pig can break your heart. We're going to find out why that is today. She empowers through joy with a concrete, no holds barred approach, and she believes in dreams and that we all have what it takes to achieve the things that we conceive. Welcome, Tiffany Knapper, to the show.
Thank you so much. And that was the most beautiful intro. Thank you for that.
You're welcome. You're welcome. So let's start off with a fun yet teachable question. Okay. What was your biggest ever waste of money?
Oh my God, that's an easy one. And I have to give a disclaimer. I don't believe in waste, but because I believe that everything teaches us a lesson. But the first thing that comes to my mind is in 2020, I spent probably $10,000 on some Facebook ads.
Oh my gosh.
That I was definitely not ready to spend. I definitely probably hired the wrong person for the job. There was zero ROI aside from the giant lesson I learned. So yeah, that would be my biggest waste of money. Did I learn a lesson? Absolutely. Do I wish I had not lost $10,000 to learn it? Of course.
Wow. Must have been a good lesson though. That's really fun because I have always wondered about spending the big bucks on advertising, if it really was worth it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it depends.
Worth it. Yeah, it's worth it. If you've got certain ducks in a row and hire the right person, I think that all matters. Yeah.
Gotcha. Oh my gosh. So good. That was a good answer. All right. So where were you born, Tiffany?
I was born in Bossier City, Louisiana. It's a small city in North Louisiana.
Interesting. And what was your family like?
Oh gosh, my family was great, but my family was probably an anomaly in the sense that my mom and dad were married when they were 17 years old, had my sister when they were 18 years old, had me 4 years later when they were 22 years old, and still raised two really incredible, strong women and went on to be very successful themselves, despite the odds that they had stacked against them because they were broken in love when they were young and got married. But I grew up in a lovely household. My parents were married my whole life until my dad passed away about a year ago, and just a really beautiful, stereotypical Southern household.
That's really beautiful. I'm sorry about the loss of your dad.
Thank you.
When you look back in your life, what is the very first thing you can remember? What's your earliest memory?
Oh, my earliest memory is being in Texas because my family, my mom and dad moved us to Texas when I was really young, like a baby, like right after I was born. And so I have a very early memory of playing with Legos with one of the neighbor's children. He was older than me. He's probably 8 years older than me. And he played with Legos, and his sister was the same age as my sister. And so we would hang out with that family, and I would play with him and Legos. And that's just an early memory I have. I was a girly girl, so it was funny that I became so obsessed with Legos at a very young age, but I think it was probably because of him.
That's really cool. What do you think that means? Do you think it has any significance?
I don't know. I've thought about it a lot because I did an exercise not long ago where they were asking us to reflect on our earliest toy memory and how it can have, I guess, a significance in what it means and how we function as adults. And so I thought, isn't that funny that I was assembling little things out of Legos? And I don't know what it means. If somebody wants to psychoanalyze it and send me a DM, I'm happy to listen. But
it, it makes me wonder about, I think of early memories as significant because of the tone or the style or the emotion. And so that memory is one of playfulness, right? It was like, so maybe that's something like, do you think playfulness is a pattern that shows up in your life?
Such a good question. My word of this year has been fun and having more fun. So yeah, there you go.
Okay. I like that. Yeah. Good. So tell me about when you were a little girl, what kind of a student were you in elementary school?
Oh, I was a good kid. I was a rule follower. I wanted to be teacher's pet and make straight A's. I was following in my sister's footsteps, and she was a very studious, ambitious child. And so I always wanted to like at least live up to her expectations because my teachers, they knew they had my sister in their class like 4 years prior. So I was a good kid. I loved my kindergarten teacher. We did a lot of art in kindergarten, and I loved that because I'm a creative at heart.
Yes, I've noticed that. You are a creative. You have the best of both brains. You have the creative and the practical business side. I love that marriage. That really comes through in your work.
Thank you. And it is literally the epitome of my mother and my father. my dad was very numerical, strategy, Excel spreadsheets, and my mom was very creative. And so I think I just got the best of both of them.
Did you grow up doing crafts and projects in family?
1,000%, yes.
What kind of things would you do?
Oh gosh, pretty early on, my mom had a random, but this was, I'll show my age, but it was a season in life where splattered t-shirts were a thing. Like you would take the paint and you would splatter the apparel. And we would, my mom and I would make these in the backyard and sell them. I don't know. Things like that.
Okay. I love that. That is something I would have done in my family. We definitely did projects like that and sold them. In fact, it's funny. Maybe we'll talk about this after we go through your story a little bit, but I wonder what kind of effect that had on your money mindset, because I was just talking about this with my mentor, our friend Craig Siegel, the other day, that when I think about, you know, making extra money with my air quotes, like you have a job and that's how you make your money. And then you make extra money by making something and selling it to people like a craft or at the flea market. And I felt like that really was something that was entrenched in my foundational patterns from childhood that's holding me back in a lot of ways. Do you feel like that came through as a pattern?
Not so much, because my mom went on to be a very successful businesswoman, and my dad quit his job, went to work for my mom, and then they retired after 10 years of her running that business. She was able to turn things, they both really turned passion projects into legitimate businesses. But I think it allowed for me to probably, if I were to dive a little deeper, I would say it probably allowed me to be open to the idea that my creative juices, my creative talents can make money. They don't have to just be a hobby. And there's always a gray line there. I don't want to give the impression that if you're skilled at something, you have to monetize it. I don't believe in that at all. But I think it allowed me to see the potential and not be so scared about trying selling my whatever that was at the time.
Yeah. I love that. That's a great reframe. It's definitely something I struggle with, is the idea of taking your creative pursuits and making them into something bigger, taking a passion project and making it into something meaningful.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. Did you have any significant people in your life when you were a little girl growing up, like heroes?
Oh man, both of my grandmothers were heroes to me for sure. I've spent a lot of time in the kitchen with both of them. So yeah, my grandmothers were my heroes. Other than that, as a young girl, I really wanted to be an editor of a fashion magazine. So I really looked up to all these women who were big names in the fashion industry or editor in chiefs of different magazines. So I looked up to them, but I didn't know anything about them except for the job they held. Yeah.
It's great. Any bullies?
I got really lucky. I didn't have any real bullies in my life in childhood. I was a bit of a peacemaker too, in the sense that I bled over into all the different friend groups. I really hated cliques at a really young age. It did not sit well with me. I didn't like it. And if someone new moved to town and they were like the newbie in the classroom, I was the first to go up and introduce myself and make them my friend and try to bring them into the group. So I didn't really experience too much bullying, and not anything that I can really remember.
That's great. I'm so glad to hear that. What about high school? What kind of a kid were you in high school? What kind of teenager were you?
Same, like high achiever, wanted to make really good grades, was just ready to get out of high school, to be quite honest. I never really enjoyed my small town life. I think I share a little bit about that in my own podcast, but not to say that Ruston, Louisiana is not a great town to grow up in. It absolutely is. I just, as I mentioned, wanted to be an editor of a fashion magazine, and that was going to be a stretch coming from Ruston, Louisiana. Mm-hmm. So I was really ready to get out. So I just wanted to make good grades. I wanted to make my family proud. I wanted to live up to my sister's fulfilling, like her not expectations, but what she had, the precedent she had set before me. And again, I had friends in different groups and I tried to not subscribe to one particular clique or another, and loved most of my creative classes, was really into French, went to France when I was 17 years old with my French teacher.
Ooh, yeah. That's so great. Yeah. Wow. Okay. So you started traveling early. Mm-hmm. What other kinds of activities did you enjoy?
Cooking a lot. Mm-hmm. Unbeknownst to me, I was an entrepreneur before I knew it, because in high school, so my sister was 4 years older than me, which meant for my whole high school life, I was a single solo child. And so I was really into cooking, and I got really into gardening, and my mom helped me build this big garden in the backyard, and I would grow herbs and vegetables. And Oprah at the time had this chef, I think her name was Rosa, if I'm not mistaken. Rosa, something like that. And they had put out a cookbook. And I got this cookbook and I started making all these recipes, and I just got really into it. So the next thing I know, my mom's boss was hiring me to make meals for their family, healthy meals for their family. I would charge $20 a plate. I'll never forget it. And I would deliver it, these like hot, beautifully literal like garden to table meals that I would make. And then I would also started cooking, like baking for women in town who had baby showers and things like that. Some school teachers would hire me to make cookies. And so I was making a little cash on the side, just cooking. And my whole family thought I was going to go to culinary school. But the truth is, I wasn't that passionate about it. I just thought it was fun.
That's amazing. How old were you when you were doing this?
I would have been 16, 17 years old.
I love it. So that was like your first job.
Technically, I've never really thought of it like that. I was a babysitter first and foremost. Mm-hmm. But yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then after high school, did you go to college?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I had written to all the fashion magazine editors as a child and found out that in order for me to be them one day, I needed to have a journalism degree. So I was like, okay, I'm going to go off and get a journalism degree. So that's what I did.
So where did you go to school?
I went to the University of South Alabama for the first 2.5 years. And then I really wasn't loving the direction. Just speaks to my high achieving, but I didn't feel like the school was really supportive of my dreams and ambitions. And they weren't really very helpful for me with getting an internship, for example. And I knew I had to get an internship. And so I said, you know what, this doesn't feel right. And so I transferred to Louisiana Tech University, which was in my hometown where I grew up. And I knew the dean of the journalism department. And I sat down with him and I was like, here's the deal, Wiley, I'll come, I'll transfer schools, but I don't want to lose any of my school credit. Like, I don't want to have to be in college longer to go here. So what are we going to do about that? And because I was 2.5 years in, I only had a year and a half left to go. And the journalism program required that you spend 2 years working on the school paper. And I was like, well, I don't have 2 years, only have a year and a half left. And he was like, we'll figure it out. We'll make an exception. And so they did. They fast tracked me into an editor role at the school paper and held up to their end of the bargain. And I graduated in a year and a half, and I got a phenomenal internship while I was there. And so that's where my degree is from, Louisiana Tech.
What about any personal relationships? Did you have a first love in this time? Anytime?
I did. He definitely broke my heart, but I did. It's fine.
How old were you when your first heartbreak? Right?
Yeah, my first heartbreak. We started dating at South Alabama. He was a few years older than me, so he graduated before I did. And then we broke up probably, I don't even know when, my junior year, something like that.
So what did you do after you got this degree in journalism?
Oh, this is where the story gets real wild and crazy because I was supposed to move to New York City. That was my plan. And one of the other girls at Louisiana Tech in the journalism department, she and I went to New York, looked at apartments, visited NYU. We were going to move there together and get an apartment together. And so we both graduated in May. We were going to hold out for the summer and make a little money and then move down to New York City in the fall together. And it was the year of 9/11. So September came. We were supposed to go down to New York in October. September came. I was just like working odds and ends jobs, just trying to make some money and save up for the move. And my dad was like, "You're not going to New York City right now." And I was like, "Okay, that's fair. I can't stay here. This is not the path I anticipated when I graduated college." So I packed up my car and I moved to New Orleans, Louisiana, and just got like a crummy little job at a marketing company and just paid my dues and said, "I'll just work for a few years until I can move to New York." And that's what I did. I worked for 2 years and then I did move myself to New York City.
And what happened in New York?
Oh, in New York, I realized that the fashion magazine world that I had been admiring from afar for so long was not quite what I thought it was going to be. And I didn't feel like I fit in. I just didn't feel right. And there was just, like I alluded to, all the clickiness that I really hated and avoided in school was pretty prevalent in those rooms and those offices. So I spent about 10 months in New York and then I was like, "Okay, I'm done. I'm ready to go back to the South. It's really cold." So my dad drove to New York City in December and we went to a Rockette show and then we drove back down to Louisiana together.
So you went back home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was fun while it lasted and made some really great friendships while I was there.
Yeah. New York is one of those places.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it. I love New York and I love visiting New York. And when I'm there, I feel really alive and vibrant. I was 23 years old at the time. Mm-hmm. I was broke and didn't know anybody at all in the city. And so it was challenging to say the least.
Then you came back into the South. Mm-hmm. And what was next for you?
What was next for me was I was like, I'm going to get a journalism degree because that's what I said I was going to set out to do. So I literally got in my car and plotted a road trip along, I guess that was I-10 from New Orleans over to Pensacola, Florida, all the way over to the coast and drop off my resume at every news station I could find on the way and then retrace my steps and come back to New Orleans. So that's what I did. I had my writing portfolio in my hand. I was dropping it off at all these newspapers, reading the classifieds, looking for job openings. This was probably pre-Craigslist. And then on the way back to New Orleans, I got a call and they're like, "Can you come in tomorrow for an interview?" And I didn't even know who it was from. I didn't know what the job was for. I couldn't remember. I had been up so many applications later. Yeah. So I'm like looking at the number. I'm like, Pensacola. Okay. Pensacola News Journal. Okay. This must be a reporter position that I remembered. I filled out, I dropped off a resume for. So I was like, "Yeah, no problem. I can be there in the morning." And so got up at the crack of dawn and drove back over to Pensacola to pretend like I lived in Pensacola. I did not. And in that interview, realized they were interviewing me not for a reporter position, but for an editor position of a different newspaper, of a weekly newspaper called The Pelican. And I was like, "Oh my gosh, I don't even know what I was being interviewed for." And I got the job and it was amazing. And basically immediately was like, "Now I have to find somewhere to live because I don't live here and they don't know that." So that was a fun journey and a really fun experience. And I got to my first journalism job was as the editor of a paper, which is wild.
That's amazing. How long did you work there?
I worked there for a year. Unfortunately, I got hit by Hurricane Ivan while I was there.
Oh,
big hurricane that hit that year. We had the eye of the storm go over us. So I was literally homeless for probably the last, I guess that hit in August and I left in January. So September, October, November, December, almost 5 months. Oh. And it was really brutal. It was really brutal for a lot of reasons. And so I was like, I got to go. And they were really sweet. I will say it's a Gannett owned paper, and the editor of Pensacola News Journal called me into her office and she was like, what can we do to make you stay? We'll find you a place to live. We'll put you up in a hotel. And I was like, well, that would have been nice 5 months ago. But I was like, nope, I'm one of those, like when I make my mind up, I've pretty much made my mind up. I give a lot of leeway until I can't give it anymore. Mm-hmm. And so that was the point. I had worked my tush off in that role, and they ended up replacing me with three different people, my one role.
Wow.
So I knew I was overworking, but I loved it. I loved what I was doing. I loved the job. No regrets. Yeah.
Good. Now, I know you worked in then the music industry. Was this what came next for you?
Next was a quick stint in PR with American Cancer Society.
Okay.
I did that for a year. And then after I got hit by Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Two hurricanes.
Yeah. So at that point, I was like, I've got to get out of this. I got to get out of this
hurricane zone.
Gulf Coast zone. Right. And so that was when I said, I'm going to go chase a more creative job in the music industry in Nashville, Tennessee. My sister lived here. I knew the city very well. So that was just another year or so ahead on the agenda.
Okay. So then tell us a little bit about that work that you did.
Yeah, I know it was amazing.
Yeah, it sounded so great. And I know you say that you worked with Christopher Cross. And mm-hmm. That song that you mentioned, you love, Sailing, is also one of my favorite songs. It's one of my songs with my boyfriend. That's one of our songs.
It's such a good song.
Whenever it comes on, we dance.
Yes. How can you not? Yeah. Yeah, that was a great job. So I got a job in the music industry. It took me 6 months. It was not easy, but I was determined not to give up. And I ended up landing the job of a lifetime. So I was with Yamaha Artist Relations at the time, now they're called Yamaha Entertainment Group. And I was in charge of PR and creative direction. So anything that had to do with an artist playing a Yamaha instrument, whether it was Elton John or Paul McCartney or Alicia Keys or the keyboardist for Maroon 5, if they played Yamaha and they were an endorsed Yamaha artist, then it was my job to make sure that story was being told in a really aligned and on-brand way. And so I got to, my first phone call I made was to Grandmaster Flash, the founder of hip hop. And then I think my second phone call was with Criss Cross. And I was just like, what is this life? And I got to stretch my wings quite a bit in that role. We were a small office and my boss gave me a lot of creative freedom. And I ended up helping launch a video division that they still run to this day, and getting to fly around the world and interview artists. And so my journalism degree really came in handy, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I helped put out a magazine twice a year that had, I oversaw all the photo shoots with all the artists and flew to the artists to organize the photo shoots and interview them on camera and launch the YouTube channel and launch Facebook and just all of these things that were really fun and exciting for me in my late 20s to learn all of that stuff. It was great.
It's like a dream job.
It was a dream job. And I dove head in as I do and worked my butt off and really learned so much in that role. And I tell people all the time, I wasn't immediately an entrepreneur, especially with my age. That was not as common back then to leave college and go straight into entrepreneurship. It's much more common now. But I think it was a beautiful thing because all of my jobs with, whether it was at Gannett or the American Cancer Society or Yamaha, three very large, prestigious organizations, I learned a lot about organization as far as digital files and just systems and processes that I know have really served me well as an entrepreneur.
Yeah. Very high level stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I hope you are loving this conversation today as much as I did. I want to take a quick break to mention something very close to my heart. It's a community that I've started around impactful books. In my book club and personal development community, we learn all the things that schools don't teach you, but they should. So I have a question for you. How many self-help books have you read? Now, be honest about this next question. How much of those books did you actually learn, retain, and implement in your life? The truth is, we all need to know how to crush it at life, to be rich, to be successful, to be happy, to be loved, to be all we dream of being. And it's all contained in the amazing books that are available out there. But we mistakenly think that simply by reading books, we can be transformed. What most people don't realize is that it's not enough to read books. You need to study them. In my personal development book club, we do the work together. And it works because you aren't just reading, you're learning. Right now, we are reading the iconic Think and Grow Rich. And in our last meeting, someone had such a powerful breakthrough that it brought us all to tears. I use techniques from my decades as a college professor in our bi-weekly live meetings to help you get the knowledge that you need to succeed. Plus, I make workbooks and activities for you. I imagine how amazing it would be if everyone interacted with the best books in the world in this way, and how much better, happier, smarter, and more fulfilled we would all be. Because the information is out there. It's all about getting it in here, as I point to my brain. Join the best book club in the world today. Link is in the show notes or my Instagram bio, or you can go to mitzicampbell.com/book club. Now back to the show.
And now I also know that you had a stint as a purse designer. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? Because you're doing all my dream jobs.
So in 2011 is when I launched my own PR branding agency, and Yamaha ended up becoming one of my first clients, as did Grandmaster Flash. So I left Yamaha and I was like, I'm going to go do my own thing. I'm going to move back down to New Orleans. And that's what I did. And at about a year after that, I was rocking and rolling. The agency was doing great. And I thought, you know what I'd really like to do? I wanted to launch some sort of product because that was just in my blood a little bit. And I thought I was going to collaborate with some of my PR roster clients to create some t-shirts or something. And then I got wind that the NFL was going to be passing this new stadium approved handbag ruling. It was just after the Boston Marathon, and it wasn't really public just yet because we weren't quite in NFL season just yet. But there was one little page on the NFL website that I somehow, I don't even know how I found it. And I was like, this feels like a big deal to me. And I went to the Saints games at the time. I was and still am a big Saints fan. And so I immediately went into my closet and I measured all my purses, and none of them met the criteria of the stadium approved size. And none of them were clear because that wasn't a thing that was common at all back then. And so I just thought, I think I could design a really cute, clear handbag. I went on eBay, didn't see anything I liked. And then once the idea was planted, there was no going back. So I sketched out some ideas on a piece of paper, and I found this girl on eBay who lived in California who was making some other things with PVC, which is the clear kind of material that clear handbags are typically made out of, that or acrylic. And I messaged her and I was just like, hey, I have this idea and I sketched it out. Would you be willing to give it a try, make it? And if it works, we can talk about you making more of these for me. And she said yes. And that was the beginning of 5 years of me making stadium approved handbags. I was the first to market with stadium approved handbags. And so therefore I got the NFL's attention and started collaborating with the NFL, which was wild. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
So you made the handbags for the NFL?
I made my handbags, but the NFL bought them from me.
Okay.
So now I haven't looked. I'm sure they make their own now, but this was early in this venture. Yeah. And so what they ended up doing was, it started off small. It started off with, they contacted me and said, hey, we want to provide these for, we've got an owners convention coming up for NFL owners and their wives, and we'd love to give one of your handbags to each of the wives in their like swag bags or goodie bags. Mm-hmm. And I was like, absolutely, let's do that. Then a few of the wives started calling me, and they were like owners' wives calling me saying, I want to buy these for my girlfriends and my friends. Great, let's do that. And then it turned into another event that the NFL had, and they wanted to buy more handbags. And I eventually flew up to New York to meet with them in person because I just knew that this could be a really fruitful relationship. So then they started carrying my handbags in their little NFL store, and that led to them selling my handbags in their NFL pop-ups at Super Bowls. And it just became this really beautiful, fruitful relationship.
Okay. That's amazing. So I have a couple of questions. One, what is the process? How are you manufacturing these?
In the beginning, this girl in California was making the part of the bag that was made out of PVC. And then she would ship them to me. And I had a little shed, for lack of a better term, that I turned into my handbag studio in my backyard. And so she would ship them to me. And then I would attach the rivets, the chains, the straps, basically, and put my logo on them and get them ready to go to market. So it was very not glamorous and lots of working hours late into the night. One time my neighbors yelled at me because I was hammering too late in the night. There were definitely instances where I was paying my friends to come help. I was like, there's not enough manpower here.
I have to make 1,000 handbags for the NFL. Can you come help?
That is exactly what the text message probably said. Yes. And it was great and exhausting and fun. And then as it unfolded and grew, I had a friend who from New York City who worked for Kate Spade. And I said to her, hey, I can't keep doing this myself. And I was starting to dabble with leather at that point too, and realized that I had this concept that would include leather on the clear bag that would still be NFL approved because I had direct access to the NFL. So I could show them my ideas and find out if they would approve it or not. And they said, yes. So I was like, okay, this is beyond my skill set. I don't know how to sew leather. And so I flew to New York and had my friend Tippy. I was like, she gave me a list of manufacturers in the New York market that she had access to because of her working at Kate Spade. And I did my due diligence, called around, found three that I wanted to meet with. And then I said, would you go with me to meet these people? Because I don't know that I really speak the language and it would just make me feel better to have you with me. She was like, sure. So we did. And we met to the three and one really stood out to me more than the others. He was a one-man show and I liked his energy and I love Ara to this day. We still chat back and forth, but found my manufacturer. And that was when things got really different because now I'm sourcing things and I'm sending everything to my manufacturer. And he was in New Jersey and everything was being produced by him. So the business changed quite a bit because when you're just making them yourselves, you have a lot more leeway as far as timing goes. Now you've really got to think through when are the supplies going to arrive? When can he get these back to me? When are they going to arrive on my doorstep in order for this fall debut or whatever it is? So it really turned into a more legitimate business at that point.
I love that because it ties into what we were talking about earlier, taking your passion and making it like you're just a perfect example of how you can do that. You went from working in your shed to doing it with a manufacturer. That's so fascinating to me. And what happened with that business?
So I ended up closing it down about 5 years in. I never was able to give it my full attention because I was running that plus my PR agency plus a co-working space at the same time. So I was really burning the candle at both ends. I did go through a really beautiful incubator program in New Orleans, Louisiana for entrepreneurs. And I had a Shark Tank success story. She'd been on Shark Tank 3 times as my mentor and could have definitely taken that business to a different level, but it wasn't my primary passion. And so I never did. And so I had hired a business coach at around some time in this time, and he wanted to buy the business from me. His wife happened to also come from the luxury fashion industry in New York. And he had 2 daughters. And he was like, I think I'd like to buy this business from you. And it could be something I could pass down to my daughters. So we went through some pretty in-depth conversations around that. Contracts went back and forth. And then both of us just decided it didn't feel right. And we pulled the plug. And I just said at that point, I said, could I go and try to find another buyer? Sure. I'm tired. I don't want to. So I just decided to sell off all my inventory and shut it down. And that's what I did.
What was the name of it?
Flying Fox.
Flying Fox. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about the idea of knowing when it's okay to quit something. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah. Gosh, that was probably one of my biggest breakthroughs I had with that business coach, Zach. He was my first business coach ever. And so I didn't really know what to expect, but I remember sitting down with him and discussing my sense of overwhelm and the different businesses that I was running at the time and crying and just getting really honest with him about where my heart was and what I was holding on to and why I was holding on to it and the ego and all the things that come into play and recognizing that something had to change in order for my sanity to come back in order for my life to improve. And I really had to go through that first probably reframe of what it means to let something go. And so he said to me, I'll never forget it. And it wasn't specifically about the handbag line. It was actually about saying goodbye to my contract with Yamaha. But that was also a very big ego death for me because I had worked so hard to get into that role and develop those relationships and to just walk away from it felt reckless. Like I felt like so many other women would be grateful for what I had and to just walk away felt reckless. So I'll never forget, Zach said to me in that moment, he said, "Tiffany, when you choose to walk away, it doesn't mean that you failed. It instead, it's like you did it once. And if you want to do that again in the future, you can. But it doesn't mean you have to keep hanging on and being miserable right now just to prove yourself. You've already proved yourself. You've already proven that you can do it." And so it was, it sounds so obvious and simple, but I had never thought of it that way. And it was this giant permission slip for me to say, okay, I've proven I can do it. I've proven I can do this work with Yamaha. I've proven I can grow this handbag line and it no longer feels good to me. So I'm going to let it all go.
Yeah. That is beautiful. I just wrote a little bit about something similar where in the past, I've done a lot of work in photography. I was a fine art photographer. I used to work a lot with flowers and doing portraits, and I don't do that anymore just because I just don't feel like doing it right now. But it doesn't mean that I'm not still able to do it. I'm a photographer. I can always be a photographer. You're a handbag designer. You'll always be a handbag designer. Mm-hmm. Once you've done something, it's a part of your identity.
Exactly.
It's like in yoga. I remember in yoga, it's so funny because I wanted to ask you too about the parallels between yoga and life. And I'm coming up with one. Like I can remember the first time in a yoga class when I did a really challenging pose, King Dancer, which I cannot do now, but I did. it was a while ago. But I remember the first time I got into this pose, and it's very difficult. Mm-hmm. And my first feeling when I got into it was like exhilaration. You had this in you all along. It's a part of you now. That's how you should look at that. That's such a great reframe for instead of letting something being, you know, you could be sad about letting it go, but instead of having regrets about it, just celebrate. That's a part of you now.
Yeah.
You are a wealth of creative tips. Okay. I think that you have such a unique way of, like I said before, marrying the creativity and the practical. And it feels to me like when I receive your emails, and I'm always so inspired by them because they're different from other business coach emails. They're different from other entrepreneur emails. They have a creative flair. And that helps me to connect with you and your message much better. So how do you think creativity serves us as humans in making connections and in business?
Oh, man, that's a how does it not? It might be an easier one to answer. I think all of us, even if you don't identify as a quote unquote creative, we are all creative beings. And we all have something that's unique to us or that comes naturally to us that doesn't come naturally to someone else. And so I'm, first of all, just really glad to hear that, that it resonates with you. Obviously, the journalism in me will never go away. I've always wanted to be a writer, always. That always came naturally to me. As soon as I start typing, it just pours out of me. I've never experienced writer's block. I've also never tried to write a book. So I'm not trying to say I couldn't or wouldn't. But when I sit down to write, it flows. It always has. And so, yeah, I think when we embody our gift and we really own our gift and we put it out there for the world to see, whatever it might be, that creative spark that is just innate in you, I think it does create this ability for other people to connect with you because there's just something unspoken there that's picked up on that's like, you're being authentically you, and it gives me permission to be authentically me. And that's a beautiful thing.
So creativity is authenticity.
I think so.
Yeah. I think so too. Are you a Libra?
I'm a Cancer.
Oh, but okay.
I've been asked if I'm a Libra before. It's funny that you say that.
Okay. I was just curious. So in business, how much of what you've been through do you think is what people would call luck?
I don't think any of it's been luck, to be quite honest. I am fully aware that there are certain such things in my life that have given me a leg up. And what I mean by that is I did have a supportive family. I did have a mother and father who were willing to pay for me to go to college as long as I went in a certain budget, stayed in a certain budget, That gave me a leg up for sure. But other than that, everything I've done has been through grit, tenacity, and just refusing to give up. And so I say that to say that I think that I don't think any doors opened to me because I was lucky. I think the doors opened to me because I was relentless and because I was willing to be uncomfortable and I was willing to knock on doors. I was literally willing to get in my car. It was a Dodge Neon at the time and drive down I-10 and drop off resumes and cold call for to try to get a job. That was not luck. That was sheer grit and absolutely, just not going to give up. And same with my job at Yamaha. I was jobless for 6 months. It was a really hard season in my life because I walked away from a job at Gannett. I walked away from a job at the American Cancer Society, two very prestigious organizations. And then I went 6 months without a job. And it was really hard for me. If you're a high achiever, I'm sure you can relate. It was really hard for me. I ended up just cooking meals for my roommate every day. But I just was relentless. I was like, I'm not taking the first job that comes my way. I'm not taking the second job that comes my way. There were job offers that came my way. And I was like, nope, that's not it. And so I don't think that was luck either. And even in the interview process, I remember just being so nervous. Who wouldn't be nervous? On the way up to that office, you're going up this hallway that at the time was just lined with platinum records by Elton John and just all these big names. And I was like, what am I doing? I've never worked in the music industry before. There's no way they're going to hire me. But I just was like, nope, I'm the girl for this job and I'm not walking away until I get the job. So I don't know if I really believe in luck in that regard.
Do you believe in the law of attraction?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I believe that when we see the potential that we have inside of us and we match our energy to that, then we can make ourselves available for things for sure. But again, I think there's a lot of work that has to come in order for that to happen. The mm-hmm. inner work that has to be done for us to say, I'm worthy of this. I'm not giving up until I get it.
Yeah. Because I think your personality just comes across as very charismatic and very confident. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how that helps you to match up with opportunities.
Yeah, 1000%. But it's also cost me jobs. I remember one of the jobs I was applying for at the time, she told me I didn't get the job because I was intimidating.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. I'll never forget it. I was like, really? I'm 5 foot, by the way, if you're listening. I am 5'0". I'm real intimidating. But I think that was it was my confidence that she was probably referring to. And it's really too bad that it was seen as a negative because I think it's a positive. But my confidence is only because I have done the work.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah. But again, not getting that particular job is a blessing because you weren't aligned and you were obviously a threat to this person. They found mm-hmm. you not intimidating, but threatening. That's what that means.
1000%. Yeah. No, yeah. Not mad that I didn't get the job and no. I'm grateful for the story because it's relatable, I think, to a lot of people. But yeah, I think my confidence does help me be able to, again, just believe that something greater out there is for me. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that allows you to have a sense of flow and ease about your life. Because it's even though I know it's been hard and you've worked really hard, it looks like you're joyful. It looks like you're like, it's an easy, not easy, like not meaning that you're not working hard. But it feels good.
Yeah. Like, yeah. And it's funny because ironically enough, I've worked hard to make it easy.
That's what I mean. That's great.
And it's funny because I was on the call the other day with a good friend and we were chatting and about some things going on. And she's it's just so great to see. I've had a lot of doors being opened to me lately and I'm so grateful. And she's, Tiffany, you have worked so hard and it's really great to see all of this happening for you. But she said, also, you make it look so easy. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that's the funny thing about even when someone talks about someone being an overnight success, that's because you're only seeing a part of the story. But I will say, part of my evolution as an entrepreneur, and especially in this season of my journey, because I guess 2024 will mark year 13 for me as being self-employed and an entrepreneur. And the thing that matters maybe more to me than anything, more to me than revenue milestones, is that I allow this journey to be joyful. Mm-hmm. And an only way it's going to be joyful is if I let go of the wheel a little bit, right? I loosen my grasp a little bit. And my mom is a really good role model in that regard, because I remember she said to me, and I won't get it exactly correct, but the theme was, you can white knuckle grip this thing and you can stress out every day and get to the end destination of whatever that's going to be. Or you could have fun every day and get to the end destination of whatever that's going to be. And it sounds so much easier. It's so much easier said than done, but it was another one of those pivotal moments where I thought, okay, she's right. Like, I know I'm going to do whatever it takes. So why don't I just enjoy it while I'm doing it? And what does that look like? And it's a very different ride and it feels really good. So I'm glad it appears that way on the outside because it feels that way to me on the inside. It really does feel so much more fun. This journey feels so much more fun for me now than it did 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I think about the word enjoyable. And if you take the word apart, you get enjoyable. If you take the joy and just lift it up, enable joy.
Ooh, I love that. That's good.
You have to enable it.
Yeah.
Yes. So you're making me think about the idea of in business, how when you're an entrepreneur, you're creating a brand and you're a business coach. So you're helping people to create themselves as a brand. And I know for me, the biggest struggle has been the transition between how I see myself and how others now see me as different from how they saw me before when I wasn't an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And so your identity, you get a lot of kind of a mind game going on with your identity as you're establishing yourself as an entrepreneur. Can you speak to that a bit?
Yeah, it's funny because this is one of those things that I'm probably not the best. I probably don't have the best piece of advice here because for some reason, and again, maybe if we trace this back to the very beginning of our conversation and my parents, for some reason, I never had that hurdle. It never held me back. I was never one of those who thought, oh no, what is everybody going to think of me? Mm. That never dawned on me. But I know that's a legit concern for a lot of people. So I don't know that I have the best piece of advice here because for me, I was always just, what do I want? If somebody doesn't understand what I'm doing, even when I made a really large pivot in 2017 and I moved back to Nashville and I closed down the co-working space and I started the process of closing down the handbag line and I decided to go through yoga teacher training and I just knew that something different was inevitable on my horizon and I didn't know what it was yet, but something had to give. So I left behind all of my friends and colleagues and contacts in New Orleans and came back to Nashville. And I knew that people would probably be like, what the heck is she doing? But I didn't care because all I could focus on was what was going to feel good and for me and how can I make myself feel better so that I could show up as a better human in the world. Yeah.
That's a perfect advice.
Yeah. Okay.
You know why? Because what you're saying is in order to be in alignment with that state of flow that's going to allow you to attract and be a magnet for those things and make life look easy and all of that stuff we just talked about, you have to put yourself first. You have to not worry about what other people are thinking. And your identity is what you say it is.
1,000%. Yes. Yeah. So and it's funny because, thank you. It's funny because now one of my dearest friends, she called me up about a month ago and she said, Tiffany, I think I need to apologize. I was like, for what? She's one of my best friends of all time. I was like, for what? She said, when you first moved away and you started doing your thing, she said, I'm going to be honest, I didn't really get it. And I said, let me tell you something. I didn't get it either. I didn't know what I was doing. You don't owe me an apology. I'm just glad you're my friend. Like, I don't care. Mm-hmm. She was like, now I get it. And I'm doing the work and oh my God, it's so amazing. And now she listens to my podcast and she's going through some pretty great epic changes herself, but everybody on their own timeline, right? Like we can't worry about what somebody else thinks or feels. We just have to take care of ourselves and then let that ripple effect do its job.
Yeah. That's the only way you can really cultivate true authenticity.
Yeah.
And that's the key.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how does yoga philosophy inform your business practices?
Oh gosh, I think it is just innate in who I am now. And so it does, it informs everything I do. But from a business perspective, it was probably what allowed me to start having more ease in the idea of trying things on. The whole thing is just get in the room and try things on. Try this pose today. Try it this way. Try it that way. Try it every day until one day it feels different, right? And so that's been huge for me in the growth and evolution, especially in the last 3 years as I started business coaching and started stepping away from PR and branding, was this permission giving that my first time I do whatever the difficult pose I'm going to do, it's not going to look like it will look in a year. And that's okay. That's part of the process. So it's given me a lot of permission in the sense that it's okay. It's normal. It's natural for things to evolve and grow and shift and you get stronger and better the more you do it. But it's like you said, I feel like about once a week, I'm like, oh, that's a perfect analogy between yoga and business. So I try to go to yoga, hot power yoga every Saturday.
Yeah.
And every time I'm in the room, she'll say, the teacher, he or she will say something and I go, ah, isn't that the perfect analogy for life?
Do you ever wish you had a notebook in yoga class?
I do have a notebook. And I will sit down with my pen and pencil. And I still have the same notebook in my yoga mat little bag that I had with me during yoga teacher training. And so it's got some yoga sequences in it and it's got some teachings in it. And it's still in my little yoga bag. And so I take it with me in the room every time. And if something comes up that just feels like an aha epiphany, I'll jump down and take a little note, or in Shavasana, I'll be writing.
I love that because I'm always coming up with good ideas in yoga class and hot yoga. My hot yoga is so hot that it's too hot to write. Like the floor's wet.
It's pretty hot. It's pretty hot, but I make it work.
Oh my God. I love that. All right. So we have to find out about the pigs. I know that we didn't really talk about your life with the farm, but people can listen to your story on your podcast to hear more about that. But I do want to know about, because I have a great affection for baby pigs, and I want to know
a
little bit of your story about pigs and why they can break our hearts or what they have to teach us.
Oh gosh, they're like so smart. So they have a lot to teach us. But so my grandmother's family is from Ohio and they are farmers still to this day. So when I would go with my grandmother to her family's, you know, house for the summers in Ohio, we would road trip from Louisiana to Ohio, and I would spend a couple weeks or a month there with her. And I was young, pretty young when we started doing these family outings. And I would get on the tractor with my Uncle Bart, which was her brother, and make the rounds with him in the mornings. And so pretty early on, and they had pigs back then, they don't anymore. Pretty early on, of course, I was a little girl. Of course, I fell in love with the baby pigs. And of course, as soon as he taught me about the runts and why they die, and it's because they don't get to the mom to get the milk because they're not as strong as the other babies, I was like, I'm solving this problem right now. And I started nursing the runts of the litter. He would give me an old glass Pepsi bottle and I would heat the milk up and I would go down there in the mornings and I would nurse the runts, thinking I was saving them. Unbeknownst to what was really happening. But I fell in love with him and I started to realize how smart pigs are and how loving they are. And so I just became really infatuated with them. So fast forward many years, probably 10 years of my pig infatuation, and my parents finally said, okay, we're going to give you a pig. And they surprised me and they gave me a pig for Christmas in Louisiana. And so I had that pig and he was great. I had several pigs over the years, but that pig in particular, his name was Willie, and yes, he became my dog's best friend, and he was huge. I don't know how big he was because I was a kid and things always seem bigger when we're kids, but he was really big. And he was my little dog's best friend, and they were so cute together, and he was so smart and sweet. But eventually pigs, as we know them, are not exactly raised to live. Their lifespan is not, it's not meant for forever, right? And so eventually we did have to say goodbye to Willie. And then my mom and dad got me a potbelly pig, and he was also a sweetheart. And yeah, they'll just break your heart a little bit because they're just so loving and loyal and smart. They're smarter than dogs. They're smarter than cats. They're really smart. You can teach them anything. Like my pigs knew how to circle, answer the phone. We had a little play phone and you would go ring and it would go answer the phone. They knew how to do all kinds of things. It's really cool.
Wow. I never knew that about pigs. You can train really them?
Uh-huh. 100%.
Wow. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they break your heart because they're so kind and so sweet, but you have to let go of them.
Yeah.
They're not forever.
They're not forever.
Pigs are not forever. There's your t-shirt.
Yep. It's too bad too, because man.
Oh my gosh. So can you tell us what are your biggest lessons you've learned in life?
Oh man. My biggest lessons I've learned in life. I'm going to go with the first one that comes to my mind, which is something my mom always taught me, which is something that my grandfather's sister, I think, always told her. So her aunt told her, which was keep a song in your heart, because life is going to knock you down at times and it's going to be a roller coaster at times. But if you keep a song in your heart, you'll always be dancing. So that's a mantra that I try to really live and breathe. Yeah. I think the other big lesson maybe that I would share is just to hold on, because it is a bit of a roller coaster. So just hold on and be ready for the ups and the downs, and don't let it knock you off course. Don't let it make you think you did something wrong. Don't let it make you think you're not capable or good enough, because you are, but get ready for the ride.
I love that. Hold on.
Hold on. Yeah.
And what about your blessings? What are you most grateful for?
I'm just really grateful for the I'm really grateful for the women in my life right now. I'll start there. I have worked really hard over the last few years, especially, but to put myself in rooms and to be open, open heart, open mind to this idea that other people are going to help me get where I need to go. I no longer have to work in a silo or think it's all on me. And so I now look around and I have all these really beautiful women around me that are so supportive, and I could not do it without them. So I'm really grateful for that.
Yeah. Great. Teamwork makes the dream work, right?
100%. And big dreams require big teams.
Oh yeah. Perfect. Thank you, Tiffany. You've given us so much to chew on today. I love talking with you. I think you're fantastic. And thank I'm really you. Grateful that you joined me today on the podcast.
Me too. This was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
That's a wrap for another episode of the Blessings Podcast. But we don't have to say goodbye yet. If you really like being in my world, I have a beautiful personal development book club membership community that I would love for you to be a part of. This is where we dig in very deeply to the heavy concepts that are presented in the most influential books of all time so that you can actually learn stuff and implement it in your life and become better, more successful, prosperous, all of the things. So if you're interested in that, mitzicampbell.com/book club or at the link in my bios, wherever you can find me online. As a college professor for decades, this is really my wheelhouse, and it's very special to me because it really helps people and it's making an impact. And I just love that. That is my mission, to make a massive positive impact on the world. But there are lots of other ways that you can connect with me, including my newsletter and also my free Facebook group. And you can find out all the information about all the ways that you can get to know me a little bit better and I can get to know you at my website, mitzicampbell.com. Love making connections. That is what it's all about for me. And so I want you to know how much I love and appreciate every single one of you. Have an amazing week, and I'll see you on Sunday for the bite-sized blessing and next Wednesday for a brand new amazing guest.